Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me, I think for the first time as a host, is Brian Hamilton.
Hey, how's it going? I'm very glad to be here. Have we been here before?
Here on this podcast? No. I think we may have been on another podcast together before.
But are you sure we weren't here yesterday?
Oh. Ah-ha. I see what you're
doing. We've been on a show together, I'm sure.
Yes. No. So anyway, very good. That's normally my job, to crack the stupid dad jokes. But yeah, thanks for being on, Brian. You want to tell everyone out there who you are and where they can find you?
My name is Brian Hamilton. I do lots of incomparable shows, the main show, lots of game show. My main project right now is called Most Important Meal, a very important breakfast journalism podcast. You can find that at Most Important Meal, most-important-meal.com, where my partner Allison Truge and I talk about breakfast and love, and it's very cute. But today we're talking about very different things from breakfast and love. We're talking about sadness.
Well, food does factor into this play.
The
lack of food. In any case, would you want to tell everyone out there what they're listening to, and because you were the one who inflicted this on us?
Yes, this is my fault. I came to you and said, hey, can we do Waiting for Godot? It's a really short thing. You just read in like an afternoon, if that. And I remember being kind of fun and interesting to talk about in high school. Let's do that. So I picked Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett, who was a French playwright in the early 20th century, 1900s. I get the numbers off. But he is a fascinating, fascinating guy. And this is his most well-known work, Waiting for Godot. Just two people waiting by a tree for a guy that never shows up. And then a few other characters pop in and do silly things, and things just roll along. It's a very weird play, but this is the one thing from high school I remember that really stood out to me as something that, you know, lasted in my brain for as long as this, to the point where when, you know, there's a podcast about revisiting your high school reading list, I thought, oh, let's do Waiting for Godot. And we had a fun experience reading this.
Well, I think I find it fascinating you call him French, because the French like to claim him. He was born in Ireland and raised in, he went to school at Trinity in Dublin, but then he went and followed his mentor James Joyce to Paris, and he spent almost his entire writing career living abroad, but he was responsible for the original version of his play, which was in French, En Entendant Godot, and he and then he wrote the English translation, which is in some ways not even a translation, because being the author, he got to change it up however he wanted to. A lot of it's the same. Some of it is written with English idioms in mind. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about the title here. In America, we tend to say Waiting for Godot.
Godot.
Godot, with the accent on the do. In the UK, it is pronounced Godot, with the accent on the front. In French, it is an unaccented language, so you would say Godot. And I just happened to be at a literary pub crawl in Ireland, where two actors performed a scene for this, and they pronounced it got it.
Wow. Oh, my God. So got it is the ravioli is a sandwich of the literary world for Waiting for Godot. But everyone gets it wrong in America, and people say it right in Ireland. The reason I am still so stubborn about saying Waiting for Godot is because Beckett himself has said, no, Godot is not God. So distancing himself from, or distancing that word from what Beckett has said it is not, I don't want to say Godot if it's not God, you know?
Beckett likes to tell a story that he got the title for this play when he was watching some young guys hanging out, and asked them what they were doing. And they said, we're waiting for Godot. Now, that seems so pat and ridiculous that I'm almost entirely sure it was made up. But Godot is actually a name in French. I don't know how common it is in French. So, yes, this is a good point. People like to glom onto the god in Godot and say, oh, this is a play about the futility of religion or something like that, which Beckett completely denied. So we can maybe take that off the table or maybe not. Who knows? You can't really tell with Beckett. Anyway, so talk a little bit about your history. You have a history with this play.
I read it in high school, and I remember thinking it was so revolutionary and weird and artsy. I was the kid in high school that was very into weird art films. I was the person that, like, showed all my friends Fight Club for the first time. I know that's not an art film, but, like, for that age, it was mind-blowing for so many people, and, like, that's where my head was as my 11th grade, not 10th grade, not sophomore, sadly, but my 11th grade English teacher handed out copies of Waiting for Godot for us to read. And I remember thinking that it was so cool and weird and out there compared to anything else we had read. And looking back, I'm starting to wonder if that kind of that excitement and attitude I had about it was because I was 16 and not because it was a good play. I didn't enjoy rereading it. My hopes and dreams were dashed, and not in the way that Beckett intended, because my hopes and dreams were dashed when I first read it. But I remember thinking that, like, it wound up so cool and different from everything else we had read. Like, that same year we had read, I forget, Madame Bovary and Hamlet, a few other things. And not that I don't like Hamlet, but Hamlet was Hamlet. This was something completely different and out of left field, and it sent me into my first real literary rabbit hole. I was obsessed with Beckett for a while after I read this because of how different it was from anything else I'd read before. But it felt a little like it was cool to have my angsty teenage feels validated by something that wasn't My Chemical Romance, you know? Like, my English class was talking about existentialism and, like, giving up and sadness and nothing to be done. And it felt so validating to have that done in English class and not on, I don't know, what, Tumblr or Twitter, whatever else was around then. So it was nice to feel validated by this play, and it was nice to see, like, such a shock to the system of theater in this way. I was also very into theater when I was in high school, so I guess it makes sense that I picked a play to read on the high school revisiting podcast. But it was, I remember reading it for the first time and imagining the staging and imagining who would play the, among my high school theater company, who would play the characters, who would do what, all these different things. It was such an immersive experience for me compared to how I've revisited it for this podcast, which is kind of another thing in my media diet, which is kind of sad.
Well, that is sad, but maybe the discussion here will save a little bit of that magic for you. I'm curious to hear about you becoming obsessed with Beckett, though, as a teenager. What was your next step? Did you go and read Happy Days?
My next step was some sort of anthology that I had gotten. It was like Beckett's other plays in like one big volume, because it was everything but Waiting for Godot. My next step, I forget what it's called. I should Google this. I'm a professional podcaster. It is this.
Crap's Last Tape?
No, that one was incredible, but it was a script for a film he did. And I think that was the other interesting thing that connected me to Beckett more than anyone else I read in high school. He was contemporary enough that you could see some of the films he had done. And what's the one? Samuel Beckett's Lips Film Diatribe. Let's see what comes up on Google for that. Not I. Okay, so it is a script for a film. It's 15 minutes long, and it is a actress completely black makeup with a spotlight just on her lips. Think the opening to Rocky Horror Picture Show, and that's what you get with Not I, which is just a giant diatribe of these lips bellowing into the camera, Lucky style. I should clarify that all black makeup just for the sake of blacking out everything but the lips. It wasn't any sort of racial commentary, thank God. But it was this amazing, like, shocking thing that I hadn't seen before. And even as like into weird art films as I was back then, I had no context for something like this. And it was a really cool touchstone. This came out in what, 1973? Let's see if it was actually done by Beckett, because I thought he died relatively recently around then.
I think he died in '80 something like.
Oh, okay. So it was a lot later.
No, maybe I'm wrong. '89. So he lived. You're right. Beckett is an interesting character, partly because he spans that time from the early modernist period through the post-war absurdist drama of France to right down to a lot of us were alive while he was still alive. Mm-hmm. And he had a long life, and he did a lot of crazy things. He was even a contributor of sorts to O Calcutta, if people out there know what O Calcutta was, which was a nude review in the late 60s that became kind of notorious. He and John Lennon were contributors to that. In any case, not something he was actually happy with, and he eventually withdrew his name from that production. But a little bit about me. I didn't read this in high school. I read this in college at the end of a survey that traced theatrical progression from the late 19th century to the mid 20th century. And what's interesting to me about Beckett, of course, is he comes along right after realism had struck really big, first abroad with Chekhov and Ibsen, probably the pinnacle of realism internationally, and then people domestically like O'Neill and even early Tennessee Williams, although Williams was much more poetic.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes along just as the new theater of method acting is very popular, both here in the States and abroad, this idea of psychological realism. And he comes up with a play that just confounds method actors. There's just no way you can approach this from a method standpoint. But he likes to tell stories about actors asking him, what was the motivation of these characters, or tell me a little bit about their childhood. He would laugh and laugh about it and say how ridiculous these people were to even try to approach the material that way. When you suggested we read this, I read this just last month on my trip to Ireland, around the same time I was doing preparation for Joyce, and it was fascinating to me because I learned a lot about the relationship between Beckett and Joyce. Beckett was a huge fan of Joyce's. He went and became a sort of a personal assistant to Joyce at one point.
Wow.
He had a kind of an abortive affair with Joyce's daughter, Lucia, who was a dancer and a remarkable artist in her own right, but he called things off there, and that led to a falling out with Joyce. But the biggest thing that led to a falling out with Joyce was Joyce's writing is extremely dense and full of allusion, and to even approach understanding Ulysses, you have to have this great knowledge of all of the Western canon, and Beckett utterly rejected that in his mid-career. He tried to be like Joyce in his early career, and he finally decided, nope, I can't do that. And he made a point like, I'm going to write something that makes no sense, that you don't have to know anything to understand. And he came up with Waiting for Godot.
And that's brilliant, especially in response to Joyce, who is so impossible to understand. I remember we did Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man the same year we did Godot. And so much of the unit we did when we were learning that book and going through the book was trying to understand all the references and pinpointing all the different ways it reaches back into, you know, Greek mythology and all these other like contemporary things that we have no touchstone for, but it's so necessary to understand those things. I haven't even tried Ulysses. I'm not touching that. That's like on top of like Mount Sisyphus. No, Sisyphus was the guy, not the mountain. You know what I mean? Not Mount Sisyphus. At the top of that mountain I will never go up is Ulysses and Infinite Jest. I'm never even going to try those two books.
the episode previous to this one was me and my wife's episode on Ulysses, and maybe listen to that and see whether or not, because I think it is a difficult book, but I think sort of like reading Shakespeare, if you read Shakespeare, it takes you maybe 10, 15 pages to get used to the Elizabethan language, and then you just kind of swim with it. Mm-hmm. And I think with Ulysses, it takes you a while to get used to what he's on about, and then eventually you just stop caring about all the allusions and you get into the meat of the story. So, you know, but that was my experience.
That makes sense. I read A Clockwork Orange when I was way too young, and it took me two, three times as long to get through the very first chapter with the like weird Cockney Russian language that Burgess invented for it. But then I swam through the rest of the book and it wound up being fine. Conversely, Waiting for Godot has none of that style. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. So instead of needing to really immerse yourself in the first few pages and then being well-equipped for the rest of what you're reading, you swim through trying to like wait for some sort of substance show up, and once it does, things wound up going off the rails.
Okay, so I assume most of the listeners out there are at least tangentially aware of this play. It is referenced so much in culture everywhere. It is the story of two men, Vladimir and Estragon, who are called affectionately between the two of them DD and Gogo. And they are usually depicted as tramps, but there's nothing about that actually in the script. The only thing that the script specifies is that everyone in this play has to wear a bowler hat. So that's the only thing. But typically, Vladimir and Estragon are portrayed as tramps after the manner of, say, Laurel and Hardy or of Charlie Chaplin. They certainly seem to be drawing from that kind of vaudevillian tradition. And they are usually portrayed on stage with Irish accents, but that's not in the script. There's one point in the script where the characters make fun of the way that the British pronounce calm. So yep. So you can't make them British. But other than that, you can make them whatever you want, I suppose. And so these two guys are sitting around in this blasted wasteland waiting for the titular Godot.
I spend so much time thinking about that wasteland when I'm reading this, because on stage, it's done so you have minimal staging, right? No one's going to go and spend $1 trillion on a set for this play, because all you need is a tree and a moon. Like, that's it, aside from all the props. And the idea that it's written so sparsely about where they are is so incredible. Like, there's one tree as far as the eye can see. I think about that so much, because of course my brain now goes to Mad Max. Like, is this taking place in the middle of Mad Max or something? Like, what is happening here that this is where this play takes place? But I love that, not just because of the staging, but because of how much extra stuff your mind has to chew on when you think about the fact that there's nothing around for miles, apparently.
Right, and from a stage craft perspective, this play was enormously influential on things that weren't anything like it. Like, I think the Fantastics basically was cribbing this stage production, this minimalist stage production, when it decided it was going to do a play that was, everything was done with poles and a moon on a stick, and things. Now, when was our town was earlier than this? I think.
Googling. Oh, 1938.
Right. So Our Town predates this. That had a very minimalist production. So there was a vogue, I think, in the 50s and 60s and early, and even on into the 70s, for that kind of very Spartan theatrical production. And it wasn't until, well, you know, it was basically Cats that destroyed all that. And the idea of theater as a destination for tourists, so they it borrowed spectacle from opera, and the productions became these big draws. And today, it's hard to draw people into a theater, at least a professional theater in New York, unless you promise them a crazy, amazing set. Now, you know, that may be changing. Hamilton had a very sparse set. But in any case, that's where we are today. But this does make this play extremely attractive to regional theaters. You know, you only have five players, and you... Anyway, so basically they wait for Godot. Godot doesn't show up, but who does show up is this guy named...
Pozzo, my favorite character.
Pozzo, and he's pulling around this guy named Lucky on a lead, on a rope, and Lucky is carrying his bags. And it just seems, on one hand, it begs to be taken allegorically. On the other hand, it defies being taken allegorically.
And that's absolutely intentional, because Beckett was so adamant that this play is just silly nonsense. But because when you're watching it or reading it or listening to it, I did an audio version of this. When you're listening to it, you think, huh, interesting. There should be a point, right? But it's so absurd and out there, and there's so much not happening that it spends so much time on the things that really don't matter in any other way except for in this play. So my favorite example of this, there's a point, I believe it's in, I forget which Lucky scene, which Pozzo scene this happens in, but there's maybe 10 or 15 lines of dialogue back and forth between Gogo, Dee Dee, and Pozzo that's about, like, oh, you need the hat. No, give me the hat. No, I'll wear the hat. No, I'll pick up the hat. And, like, for a solid 30 seconds of the audio I was listening to, it was them going back and forth about getting Lucky his hat back. And I can't believe that people watching this would think, okay, there's something here to this. But no, because of its roots in vaudevillian style, even if it's not there, you know, expressly or intentionally, that vaudevillian style definitely makes this feel like a comedy in a way that I'm sure was a tongue-in-cheek reference to the fact that people are going to try to find some sort of meaning in this dribble.
Right. Well, I think that is the most slapsticky part of the whole play. There's plenty of silly wordplay. There's plenty of conversations that go nowhere, in spite of the fact that these people seem to exist in a place that's outside of time and space. They make reference to other things, to other places. They make reference to religion. They make reference to schools of philosophical thought. There's a point where basically Vladimir is the slightly more intellectual of the two. He's the one who seems to, more than anyone else in this play, realize that something's wrong about this world that they inhabit. Mm-hmm. Whereas Estragon is the one who's wants to get his boots off, or he might want to get them back on again, depending on which day it is. He's the one who is concerned with whether or not they're going to get food to eat. He's the one who wants to hear Vladimir tell a dirty joke. But in many ways, the two characters are almost sides of the same person. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have remarked on this fact that there's a way in which the two characters are entangled that make them seem like parts of a fractured mind, almost.
Yeah, I definitely get that. What is your experience when reading this and going through the two characters? I've always treated them as interchangeable, almost, which I know is not the point, until the second act when Estragon forgets everything that happened the day before. To me, they felt very similar as characters just going forward and having things happen. I really didn't see any identifying characteristics there until things started to get weird in the second act. What was your experience with differentiating them?
It is hard if you're reading this and you don't make choices in your head about their portrayal the way that actors make choices. It can be very hard to differentiate one from the other. But I think, actually, in performance, that's a choice that can be made. You can make the choice to have them very strongly differentiated. And typically, there was a famous production, and one of the early productions in the States, in which Burt Lahr played Estragon, and that kind of makes sense. You know, he play him in this kind of a dopey, slow-witted, clownish, buffoonish way. Not that Vladimir is particularly smart or anything.
It's more but that, of the two.
but of the two, Vladimir's the one who pays attention to what's going on and who starts to realize that the action of this play is circular, because after one whole day of waiting for Godot and having a young boy come up and explain to them that Godot isn't coming, he's also a mysterious character, this young boy. He calls Vladimir Mr. Albert. And he...
Yeah, what's up with that?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. And he claims to know Godot and have dealings with him. He claims that Godot beats his brother. If you go through the first act, Vladimir says a few things that you don't pick up on until the second act that make you think that this may have been going on for a lot longer than you think it has. Because Vladimir asks the boy, have I met you before? Do we know each other? When the second act comes along and most of the same things happen that happened in the first act, in this second act, Pazzo and Lucky have changed somewhat. They've become much more pathetic and strange. And mm-hmm. Pazzo has become blind, or at least he claims he's blind, and he claims to have lost his memory and has no memory of the day before. When the boy arrives at the end of the second act, Vladimir is even more curious as to, is this the same boy? Were Pazzo and Lucky the same people? What's going on here? There's something very strange happening here. Whereas Estragon can't even remember whether the boots he left the day before are his.
They fit you perfectly. Of course they're yours. Can I tell you a secret?
Yep.
Don't tell my 11th grade English teacher. I didn't read Act 2 of this because I knew going in that it was identical to the first act, except for Lucky and Pazzo being different. And would you consider that a twist? That at the end you realize, oh, this has been going on for so much longer. For people that aren't steeped in the culture of theater and literature and things like that, that would know, you know, this play going in, do you think that's considered a twist? Because I don't think it is.
It's not considered a twist, but I think the way that there is a kind of a creeping horror that arises. Given the strangeness of this play, there's a lot of choices that you have to make in production. And there is actually a one movie version of this that was made in 2001. It's interesting because Beckett did not like the idea of this play being adapted either for television or for movies. Mm-hmm. He didn't let it happen in his lifetime. And so within a decade or so after his death, there was an attempt to make this movie version. And it's quite a good movie if you see it. But it makes the decision that this is a tragedy very strongly. And it plays everything very seriously and very ponderously.
Exactly. And once you get past the very slapstick Act 1 and things start to get really weird in Act 2, the fact that you have both tragedy and comedy for the exact same events is jarring. And that was one of my favorite things going through this again, was realizing that the growth and change in the characters that I didn't see the first time I read this is so much more interesting than the academic exercise of thinking, okay, what if a play had the exact same Act 1 and Act 2? And I think that was what the most rewarding part of revisiting this to me was, seeing that the differences between Act 1 and Act 2 and giving some of the characters some more characterization, because, again, there's not much difference between Vladimir and Estragon, but you get this really great realization from Vladimir by the end when he realizes, oh no, this is going to be going on forever. This is awful.
Right. Well, there are a couple other things that I think this might be a reference to. As much as Beckett tries to play it coy, this is usually located in what's called the theater of the absurd, which, depending on where you want to start, you can either start before World War II with people like Pirandello's Six Characters in Search of an Author, although I don't think that that really is an absurdist play. I think that's more of a surrealist play. But this comes right after Ionesco's The Bald Soprano, which is a very famous French absurdist play that also devolves into utter madness. It starts in utter banality, devolves into utter madness, and then it stops and it begins again. Famously, at the very end of The Bald Soprano, everything starts again with the same dialogue, the same setting, and you're right back to the beginning. And I think that that is a reference that Beckett's audience can't help but have, looking at this. The other thing that absurdist theater does is it's supposed, in its relationship to existentialism, is it's supposed to elucidate that the human condition is meaningless, and that part of the heroic struggle is to recognize that can be a moment of existential terror when you recognize the meaninglessness of things. And Vladimir is the one character who starts to realize there's something a little bit off about his world. I mean off in the same way that, I don't know if you're familiar with it, the final episode of the IT Crowd, where Roy suddenly says to the other characters, "Doesn't it seem to you that the things that happen to us are very strange?"
I have not seen the last episode of IT Crowd. I love the first two series. I haven't seen the last one.
Oh, they came back with like a single 2-hour final episode that wraps things up. But
that's amazing.
But there is this moment of realization about that there's something absurd about what's going on. And in Vladimir's case, he's starting to realize that things don't make sense. And he's also starting to realize that things could have been going on for a long time now. And he's not sure what that means, and it's upsetting to him. We don't know that realization is going to lead to any kind of awakening or escape from him. Probably not. But at least the audience are invited to recognize, I guess, the circularity of our own lives and the absurdity. There is something absurd and circular about life in a post-industrial society, if you want to say go that far, and say, you know, get up every day, do the same thing, and you aren't really aware of the way in which nothing changes around you, or in the way that you have no effect on your world.
Exactly. There's so many other pieces of media that use that as a twist, like a straight up twist. I don't want to say any of them for fear of spoiling what they are, but like, there's a few episodes of Black Mirror that end this way where you realize this is like the middle of a giant, terrible story that's been happening on and on over and over again for these characters. And what's so cool about it is that there's never any character development when that happens. It's never for the character's sake. Which is my least favorite thing about this kind of twist, when you realize that the characters are completely useless in changing their fate. It's like a cool point to make, especially in Waiting for Godot, but there's so many other things where you think, oh, I wish there was something more the character could do and there could be some growth, and it's always the last thing that happens, so you realize that the character that you've been like rooting for the whole time is either a terrible person or hasn't been doing like the same things they've said they've been doing. I don't know. I wish that more things that did this trope gave characters more agency in doing things. And there's one particular TV show I want to talk about that does it, but I don't want to spoil what it is because it's one of the best reveals I've ever seen. I like that Godot used it so much more about the story and a bigger statement about the human condition, as much as Beckett denies it, I'm sure there's still something there about it. And I like that he gave it to a character that really didn't have much other characterization in the play, so that there was nothing lost on me. Like, oh man, they reduced this character to a plot twist. That's lame. But I'm really glad that they gave it to a character that didn't really have much else to do in the show.
So much of this comes down to performance. I mean, the other thing, when you were talking about the ways in which the characters don't grow, they don't learn, and in a way we're invited not to care about them, this reminds me of the other towering figure of 20th century drama, Bertolt Brecht, who famously developed this theory that you had to, the audience needed to be estranged from the characters. The characters had to be, they had to realize that they were watching something fake. They had to be reminded of the artificiality of theater at all times, because only then is the audience going to engage in what the important thing is, which is to examine the work of art for its themes.
100%.
Right. That's the way that Brecht approached it. Now, Beckett is playing with that. He is playing with the fact that the audience can't really get close to these characters in a way. But I think Beckett, in a way, is being led a lot more intuitively and a lot more with a sort of a silliness about what he's doing. Now, it comes down to whether or not you have a director who's willing to go silly, or whether you have a director who wants to play up the angst of this play. And then it comes down to the actors. And you go, if you look at the history of production of this play, you can see all kinds of interesting people have taken these roles on. I think the most interesting thing nearest to us is there was a production that starred Patrick Stewart and yes. Ian McKellen.
I was hoping we'd bring this up. I love that they did that.
You can imagine that they would bring an enormous amount of comedy to the roles. And they're perfect actors for it in a way, because they come from the British tradition of what's called presentational theater, where they don't do method acting. The RSC does not do method acting. It's all artificial, and it's based in voice and diction and being completely aware of your body and where it is on stage. And it's glorious, I think. It's a wonderful tradition. If you compare that again, when we were talking on the Streetcar Named Desire episode about Marlon Brando and what he brought to the role, is that mumbly, animalistic, interior life. And that works for Williams. I think if Marlon Brando tried to play this, there would be some sort of riot in the theater.
Exactly. If 16-year-old Brian had directed this play, it would be that super angsty, like depressing. I would so have focused on the depressing aspects of it, and I would be there waiting in the wings. Did you hear that, everyone? There's nothing to be done. But if I directed this today, I would have leaned in so much more to the comedy, because you're right, that lucky scene is hilarious. It's the fact, my favorite thing about the fact that Lucky has like a 4 or 5 minute diatribe in this play is that somebody has to dedicate weeks of their life to memorizing this horrific, random, like complete random.org set of characters and words and just things to say and sound effects for 5 minutes of one joke in one play. It's this comedy, like this existential comedy about like somebody had to dedicate so much time to make this one stupid joke land. It's my favorite thing about this play, that one really dumb diatribe that somebody has to dedicate their lives to.
Right. Well, you can see the roots of Monty Python in this play. There's the part at the beginning where the two men consider hanging themselves on the tree, and they want to do it because they hear that will bring them sexual release. Mm-hmm. And they want to try it out to find out whether that's the case. But then they argue about who should go first, because if one of them is too heavy, at least that person will break the rope and they'll both be saved. But if the other one's too light, then the second one can't get any help in killing himself, basically. And it's played very silly. I mean, obviously it's a joke about suicide, which is a horrible thing, but this is there is nothing horrific about their discussion. And the joke, it's a running joke. It's brought back at the end of the first act where they say, oh, we got to remember to bring rope tomorrow.
But they never do. They always want rope and never have it. That Tony Sindelar is reading this play and being like, hey, you can't use rope for that. Now, I remember loving this play so much and seeing so much more in it than I do now, but you were right. This discussion is really reminding me of the comedy in listening to this. I, in preparation for this, I listened to a recording of the, you mentioned his name earlier, the guy that played Cowardly Lion on Broadway.
Oh, Bert Lahr.
Thank you, Bert Lahr. I listened to his recording of it, of this play, and it's excellent. It is a very, very good representation of it, and you can hear the Cowardly Lion laugh. It's wonderful. But it gave it a certain life and comedy that I hadn't thought about in so many years because my teenage brain was so focused on the angsty existential parts of it. But Pozzo is such a funny character, and Lucky is such a funny character, and it makes it that much funnier that there's so much more there's so much contrast between the depression and the comedy, to the point where he calls it a tragicomedy. And what the term for Romeo and Juliet, he just said a comedy, right? It's just a comedy, but it's also a tragedy by the end. Like, tragicomedy is exclusive to Beckett, right? It wasn't something Shakespeare used.
People like to argue about Romeo and Juliet, whether it gets to be called a tragedy or not, because of the traditional boring Aristotelian definition of what a tragedy is, which I'm not going to get into here now, because although in some ways I guess that's the most sophomore lift thing I could do. But so people argue about whether that gets to be a tragedy or not. It generally gets, if you buy a 3-volume set of Shakespeare that has comedies, tragedies, and histories, they will put that in with the tragedies. But on the other hand, they will put I don't know where they put it in Winter's Tale or in those things. I guess that's a comedy as far as they're mm-hmm. concerned. Anyway, that's for another one. Come back on and we'll discuss the problem plays of Shakespeare.
Yeah, I don't know. I really enjoyed rethinking this, even if I didn't enjoy the experience of re-listening to it. And going back to Brecht for a second, I love the idea that if you do a play right, and you do something like Waiting for Godot, which is such a challenging play, if you do that right, you're almost alienating the audience because there's so much weird stuff going on that the audience doesn't know what to make of it. And even if they know what to expect going in, it's still 2 hours of just silliness and nothingness that is intentional and there and meant to make the audience feel things while also making them laugh. There's so many layers to it that I'm sure, like, this isn't going to be like a headline thing on Broadway. Maybe it is, but it's never going to be like a Hamilton crowd pleaser. It's never going to be like a Disney adaptation of one of their movies for Broadway. This is going to be a weird thing that only people that love theater and people that really appreciate this kind of literature and the way that people put shows together and write shows. This is such a fascinating media property to me in general because of all these different ways that people can consume it, and also that you need to think about if you're going to make another one of it, which is why I love that Beckett never wanted it to be filmed, because there's so many, like, you have like a local Waiting for Godot production, you have maybe a cast recording of Bert Lahr or something like that, but you're never going to have one definitive version of Waiting for Godot, except maybe the one in 2001, which I haven't seen, but he never wanted that to be the case, which leads me to my other favorite thing about Beckett. He went on the record with so many different questions about it. He's confirmed that no, Lucky is not Godot. No, Godot is not God. No, all these different things. Like, he has said so much about this play that as much as I like to think it's some sort of mythical, weird thing that was born like straight out of his brain onto a page perfectly in this absurd way, he's confirmed so much stuff that that people really do think about. And again, the fact that it's so contemporary to us now, I love that there's such a rich amount of stuff you can go in and read that Beckett has said himself about his play that's so intentionally inscrutable, and that's hilarious to me.
Beckett is one of those artists that you love because he was always on as an artist. He committed to the persona of playwright. You have people like Beckett, you have people like Oscar Wilde, you have people like, well, Tennessee Williams, who you love just for the characters that they themselves were. And those characters that they portrayed through the world were also crazy and unlikely and probably not who they were on the interior, but that's who we get.
Exactly. And especially compared to today, where there's social media and you have direct contact with artists, you really don't get that like always on artistic anymore, except for a few very distinct examples today where I don't know. I love that people get to be real people now, as opposed to you know, people like Beckett who have made amazing things and himself was an amazing persona of an artist. But if Beckett existed today, I don't know if Waiting for Godot would exist today because of that lack of distance between the consumer and the artist.
We've mentioned Hamilton several times here. Lin-Manuel Miranda is probably the poster child for an incredibly earnest, wearing his heart on his sleeve guy who just makes himself available to everyone and tells everyone exactly what he was thinking when he was writing what he was writing. That's kind of the opposite of what Beckett was.
Exactly. Even though he's confirmed a lot of things, you don't get the insight of like the Hamiltome with Beckett. Because he's never going to be there for every single production of Waiting for Godot. All you need is four people with too much time on their hands and a tree, and you have a production of Waiting for Godot.
Well, a kid, too. You need one kid.
Eh, you don't need the kid. I really want to see, like, a local production, like, really screw with the audience and have a set of twins as a boy in Act 1 and a boy in Act 2 or something like that. So that, like, are you the same person as yesterday? I think so, sir. I don't know. Like, I would love to see, like, oh, wait, that's canon now that there were two boys? Who knows? Maybe that wasn't the same person. Maybe it was. I really want something like that to happen.
You know what's telling is apparently Beckett's own favorite production of this play was one that was put on in a jail. There was apparently a production. Let me see if I can find a reference to it. It was in Germany, actually, in Remscheid in Germany. There was an inmate who had a copy of the play in French and asked for permission to stage the play, and Beckett gave it. And Beckett was enormously moved by this. I don't think he ever actually got to see the production, but he was really, really interested in this. And he was in correspondence with the inmate who was putting this on. So it says a lot again about what Beckett was on with this play, that would be his favorite production.
Exactly. I've never had any sort of experience like that, but I remember in high school, we did the same year we did Waiting for Godot. So junior year of high school was a very big literary year for me. We also did a unit on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Ah, yes.
And somehow there was a group of people that were doing a project on it in my 11th grade class who got in touch with Tom Stoppard, and they had email correspondence about their project, their essay that they were writing together with him. And first of all, if you think about Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, it is Shakespeare plus Beckett equals this amazing play. It's one of my favorite things I've ever seen, where Hamlet plays Lucky. It's so great. But it's like, it's so incredible to think that these, like, stereotypically inscrutable artists are so accessible and able to be who they are in ways that, like, especially now with email, but even back then with Beckett, who was so uppity about his persona and the way that he presented himself, he was still able to make himself available to this inmate who loved his play so much he wanted to perform it in prison. That's incredible.
Sometime we'll probably get around to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. Definitely a play that I think owes an enormous debt to Waiting for Godot. But any last words you want to put in here before we wrap up? Have we changed your mind?
As so often happens on Incomparable episodes, I will enjoy the discussion so much more than I enjoy the work. And that makes it all worth it to me. So thank you again, John, for having me on the show.
Thanks to co-host Brian Hamilton. His podcast is Most Important Meal. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join the discussion on the Facebook page and on the Incomparable membership Slack. Write me with your book suggestions. I'm always looking for new ones. And keep up on the reading, because everything will be on the final.